Thank you. Please be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument for petitioner in FFE Transportation versus Ford.
Good morning. I'm here on behalf of FFE Transportation Services this morning to ask this court to do two things. Number one, hold that a person or an entity that uses a product for purposes of conducting its business is not strictly liable for defects in that product. And number two, we ask this court to hold that a trial court has discretion to determine whether expert testimony is necessary in a case involving ordinary negligence, and that given the allegations and evidence presented in this case, that expert testimony was in fact necessary here to establish a standard of care and a breach of that standard of care. Now, first, with regard to the product liability issue, there is this court in Armstrong Tire over 25 years ago established a core requirement for finding somebody strictly liable for a product defect, and that is that the defendant be engaged in the business of introducing products into the stream of commerce for use or consumption by the consuming public. In this case, the Court of Appeals, in its opinion, apparently assumes that requirement to exist. All the Court of Appeals does in this case is address whether or not there was a transaction between FFE and its contract driver, which there was. There was an independent contractor arrangement between FFE and its driver. It's very common in the trucking industry for this type of arrangement to exist. The driver provides his tractor. FFE owns trailers, uses those trailers for purposes of delivering products for its customers. Obviously, without the trailers, it would be a little difficult to do that. So FFE owns the trailers. It enters into these agreements with contract haulers like Mr. Fulgham in this case. As part of the arrangement, he provides the tractor. FFE provides the trailer. He is required to haul. He cannot haul for anyone else. He's got to haul for FFE. As part of the arrangement, he receives a percentage of each load that he delivers on behalf of FFE.
So he's using different trailers over and over again, or the same trailer over and over again?
No, he's using different trailers. These trailers are at a particular location. In this case, it was Hillshire Farms in Kentucky, had been loaded with sausages, I think. And what FFE says is, okay, you go to Kentucky, pick up this trailer, deliver it to Houston. So when he gets to Houston, he drops off that trailer, and that trip is done.
There may be
another trailer there to pick up, or conceivably he could, you know, he could wait overnight while that trailer is unloaded and then reloaded. But he's directed by FFE. He delivers these products as ordered by.
Does he have a choice as to how much or how little he works, or? And if he only or to work 10 weeks a year, as long as he doesn't do any work for anybody else, that's okay? Or do you all set his schedule, essentially?
I believe it's a independent contractor arrangement. I don't recall if the contract has any specific requirements of how much that he has to conduct. I mean, he obviously gets paid per load, so it's his incentive to haul as much as possible. And FFE will call him and tell him, okay, we need you to pick up this trailer and take it here. I don't think there's any specific requirements as to how much he's supposed to work.
FFE's a pretty big operation, and they have their own employees who drive these in similar situations?
They do have their own employees as well.
And roughly what percentage is that, you know?
I do not recall the percentages. I mean, there is a significant percentage that are independent contractors.
So they have employee drivers and they have independent contract drivers. Do they ever, that's a big word, I guess, but do they rent empty trailers in a lease situation where a driver says, I'd like to, you know, lease an empty trailer and find some body to pay me, other entity to pay me to, you know, fill it up and move goods?
No, no. The drivers are not soliciting business for FFE. The customers, FFE's customers are different entities that need goods delivered from place to place.
If I came to FFE and said I sure would like to, you know, lease one of your trailers and make me, you know, some money, would they lease me an empty trailer?
No, I don't believe FFE leases its trailers. These trailers are used by FFE. FFE uses these exclusively for delivering goods for its customers. The only distinction, really, between the independent contractor arrangement and its employee drivers are the independent contractors provide their own tractor. So that's it's obviously the FFE's advantage to not have to own all the tractors, but it does, in fact, own all the trailers and provide those. Now, the case law, Armstrong Tire, Dallas Court of Appeals case, Corpus Christi Court of Appeals case, Hernandez, the Fifth Circuit, all require that there be some release of the product to the ordinary consuming public, and that where the product remains within the industrial context, and that where the product remains used for purposes of conducting that entity's business, that does not release the product into the stream of commerce, and strict liability doesn't apply.
What if GM said we aren't going to sell any more cars? We're going to lease them to you for the life of the car, and every 6 months, y'all are test drivers. Every 6 months, every owner sends in an evaluation form, and we'll send them $20 for doing that.
And are they, I mean, are...
That wouldn't really be in the stream of commerce yet, because GM's just having like a 30-year test on its vehicles before it starts selling them again.
Right. And I think that if GM's not making, if that's not GM's business, now, I mean, I think in that case, that would be a necessary part of GM's business. GM's business is selling vehicles and releasing vehicles into the stream of commerce. And I think whether it's a testing process, I mean, this is a testing process unlike Armstrong Tire. Strict liability would apply there. I mean, I can't see GM doing that, but I think that would. I think that would.
Depends on how broadly we write.
That's right.
But I suppose if Mr. Fulgham had been an employee, there wouldn't be any question that this had not been released.
I don't think so, based on the case law. I mean, there's no case law addressing this kind of independent contractor situation. You do have case law involving railroads, where railroads provided some products to a trucking company who's on the railroad premises and are loading trailers onto a railroad car, and the employee of the trucking company is injured. But in each of those cases, what the case law says is that you're still using that product for purposes of conducting your business. That's not your business, is to sell those products that are then used to load trailers onto a railroad car.
The employee could sue the manufacturer, but they could not sue their employer.
Right. And that's exactly what happened in this case. Mr. Fulgham sued the manufacturer, who was Wabash, ultimately settled out prior to trial. And Wabash is who FFE bought its trailers from.
What about U-Haul? Are they in this? Do they put trailers or trucks in the stream of commerce?
U-Haul does. U-Haul obviously puts the rental vehicles into the stream of commerce. That is their business. Their business is not hauling things on behalf of customers. Their business is placing these products into the stream of commerce. Their business is giving these trucks, trailers, other cargo vehicles to its customers for their use. And that's their business. So in that sense, they're putting it in the stream of commerce. the lease distinction is, I mean, it's unquestionable that a lease in and of itself is sufficient to release a product into the stream of commerce. I mean, that's been answered pretty clearly.
What if FFE didn't own any of its trailers then, and in a document called a lease had all these independent contractors with its, I think I saw something in the briefing, over 3,000 trailers, and they were all leased and the products were delivered that way. Would the trailers then be in the stream of commerce?
No, because they're still, FFE is still using those products, whether they obtain them by lease or however they are using them and are providing them to their independent contractors or employees for purposes of conducting their business. They are not releasing it in the stream of commerce.
So you don't think whether it's called a lease or not is determined?
No, not at all.
So following up on Justice Heck's question about the employer, do you focus on that relationship between, say, Mr. Fuldrum and the company, such as Belmont? Is that important to you?
No, I don't think so, because I mean there's no question that there was a bailment in this case. And I don't think whether it's a bailment, whether it's a lease, whether it's a sale, the case law is pretty clear that any of those situations are sufficient to release a product into the stream of commerce.
What about a joint venture?
I'm sorry, Aaron?
What about a joint venture?
What the analysis has to boil down to is what it gets back to is whether a joint venturer or whoever the entity is with the product, whoever the bailor is or the seller or the lessor, they have to be in the business of selling those products or releasing those products into the stream of commerce. And where the use of the product is simply incidental to what their business is, then the policy the policy is not there. The policy stated by the restatement and the cases that have followed the restatement that where you are a commercial seller of a product, that you assume a responsibility where not to put unreasonably dangerous products into the stream of commerce. And where that is the core of your business is selling these products or selling these vehicles or leasing these vehicles, then that is what that's where your bread and butter comes from, and so you are going to stand behind those products, and if you're marketing those products to the public, then you're going to bear the burden of injuries caused to the public by those products. But that does not that policy does not exist where that is not your business. And I think if that requirement is ignored, then you get into a situation where, I mean, every trucking company is now going to be strictly liable for whatever product, whatever vehicle it puts on the road. And taking that a step further, I mean, any employer that gives a product to its employees for purposes of conducting their business is now going to be on the hook for on the product defect hook. They're going to be strictly liable. So
what if FFE made all of its income as a company from simply leasing trailers to independent contractors? No products were delivered in the trailers. Well, if they were, they wasn't part of FFE's business. FFE's entire business was leasing 3,000 trailers and getting income from that. I take it, based on your analysis, that would be releasing the trailers into the stream of commerce?
That would be. And in that case, they would be strictly liable.
And what if 600 of those trailers were leased for income purposes for FFE and the others were used to deliver products for FFE? How would your analysis conclude in that situation?
Well, then I think the analysis, you have to look at the totality of the circumstances. The restatement is pretty clear that an occasional seller of a product, I mean, even where a business is selling some of its products, just, you know, depreciated value, they're just trying to get rid of it, where you're just an occasional seller of a product, strict liability is not going to attach. And what in the analysis in that situation is you look at the totality of the circumstances to determine, you know, to what extent this is, in fact, the business. whether selling these products are the business or whether this is just an incidental part of their business.
Who makes the decision what load to get, where, when, and all of that?
FFE makes that decision. FFE, the loads are loaded by the customer. FFE calls its drivers and tells them where to be.
I guess we'll get to the expert witness and the rebuttal.
Thank you, Counsel.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Ken Yuque will present argument as respondent.
May it please the court. Conceptually, I cannot distinguish this case from the rental car case or as a U-Haul case. I realize at first blush there's some things involved here that one might think, well, this really isn't a strict product liability case. But when you start looking at each of the elements is present here, and I see nothing in our case law that distinguishes this case and takes it out of the strict product liability area.
Your agreement, as to Justice Hicks' question, if Mr. Fulgham had been an employee?
It's done for. Because there has not been that transfer of possession to an outsider, whether it's an independent contractor or whoever. If an employee is simply using his employer's equipment, there is no continuance of the commercial transaction.
It's not like Mr. Fulgham has 30 different companies he can choose to work for that morning, and he's choosing whose load he's going to haul, right? He can only either hauls FFE or he's staying at home.
In this particular case, that's true. That's not true with all trucking companies.
Well,
not
I know, but I mean, we're talking about him.
Yeah.
I mean,
in this particular case, that's true. That's true.
So it's FFE or nothing. So why, with that in mind, with that understanding, why conceptually should this be different just because he's bringing his own tractor and it's an independent contractor?
Well, for one thing, Mr. Fulgham doesn't have the protection that most employees have. He doesn't have workers' compensation provided by the employer. He doesn't have the, that thought escaped me. There was one other reason I had in mind here. But
what does any of that have to do with stream of commerce? I mean, I realize an independent contractor is a money-saving plan for the employer, or they wouldn't be handling their business that way. But why does that make it? What does that have to do with whether the product is in the stream of commerce or not?
Because it continues that one step beyond the purchaser, just the same as in the rental car companies. The rental car, just because he picks up 50 different trailers at different times and pulls them for FFE, to me is no different than if John Q. Businessman goes to Hertz 50 times a year and leases 50 different vehicles from them. I can't see the conceptual distance. On a U-Haul case, let's say that the renter of the U-Haul trailer says, you're going to Kansas City, Mr. Customer. I want you to take this load, you know, whatever it is, this box to my niece. Would you mind doing that? And I'll discount your fare or your rental half price. Does that take the case out of strict product liability simply because the renter of the equipment was doing something for the party that rented to him the equipment? To me, it does not. I don't think it's a workable distinction to say if the lessee is doing something for the lessor, that automatically takes it out of product liability law.
Well, let's say I own a chemical plant, and I own two chemical plants, and I have a flammable explosive chemical, and then I have a trucking company that I've contracted with that's an independent contractor to haul this chemical from one plant to the next plant frequent basis. And let's suppose while that's being transported by this independent contractor, one of the containers blows up and injures the driver. Now, am I liable as the owner of the plant and the owner of that product that I'm just shipping from one of my plants to the other? Am I liable in strict liability to that driver?
I think if a company is in the business of putting a product out on the road frequently, like several trailers, or in your case, this chemical container goes on the road from time to time, regardless of who it's hauled by, as long as it's not hauled by an employee, there should be that strict liability attached to the company that puts that product on the road, because they are in the best position to make sure there's no defect in that
truck. So we've taken that step. Let's bring it back to a premise. Let's suppose that I have containers like that or asbestos-containing materials on my premises, and independent contractors are working in and around that. Am I liable to them for injuries for strict liability? Is that in the stream of commerce? So what's the difference?
Hillshire Farms, where this was loaded, when their workers come onto that trailer and load it up, there was no transfer of possession from FFE to any independent partner. The same thing, to me, that should be the basis of the distinction in faith.
Well, I hire people to carry my asbestos sacks from one place on my premise to the other. An independent contractor does that, and some of these workers, the independent contractor, have an asbestos-related disease. They've just transported it from one place on my property to another. Should I be liable?
Still on your premises?
Mm-hmm.
No. There's not the transfer of possession by some commercial transaction. Just because you have an independent contractor working on your premises does not mean that there is that commercial transfer by which legal possession to that article was transferred. In other words, if you just pick up and use something that's on the premises...
Well, these people are hired to do the day labor, to move this pile to that pile.
No, I understand. That'd be the same as building a house or anything else. The fact that it is a product that's on those premises that injured somebody does not transfer the legal possession of that product via some commercial transaction, which in this case was an independent contractor agreement specifically related to the trailer.
Well, you say it transferred possession, but only during the time that was actually being used in transportation. In other words, he didn't take this trailer home every night. He didn't drive the same trailer every day.
No.
He didn't have the right to use the trailer for other commercial purposes. I mean, he only uses it for FFE purposes.
As far as what's set forth in the independent contractor relationship or what's set forth in the working relationship?
Well, in regard to back to this case, your client and FFE.
I'm not for sure whether he could have gone to them and said, you know, I want to rent this trailer to hire something, to haul something. I don't know whether they would have done that or not. I do not know. That hadn't come up in any of the testimony. But let's look at that situation. Let's assume that Larry Fulgham was not pulling this trailer with FFE's merchandise or something FFE had contracted for, but Larry Fulgham was going to do his own product, whether he was going to move his furniture out of his house or whatever. Does a different rule apply there where he picks up a product from somebody else, rents it, and he is injured by use of that product while he's pulling it on the road? Should that be any different than what's going right here? Just because FFE has contracted to haul that stuff in the back of the trailer, should that be the distinction? I don't see a meaningful distinction there. It's the commercial transaction by which he obtained use of that trailer, regardless of what purpose he's put it for. Larry Fulgham, we have to distinguish this employee independent contractor thing. Employees are to be treated differently because there is not that legal release of possession of a product that came into the stream of commerce via the traditional route.
That's the piece I don't understand. You said the relinquishment of the legal something or another.
I'm sorry.
That's the piece I don't understand. I mean,
okay. It
is a bailment, however you want to describe it, whether your employee's in the tractor pulling the trailer or an independent contractor. Don't they both have the same right to have possession of the trailer at the same time?
If that tractor is being pulled by an employee, no, I don't think there is any bailment. I don't think you can bail something to your own employee, can you?
I don't know. I'm just asking, I don't understand the practical difference or the legal difference in terms of the right to possess that trailer.
To me, Larry Fulgham is an independent contractor. He's a third party. He's a member of the public. So what if he has a contractual relationship with FFE? He is still an independent contractor. He's a member of the public that came.
Well, what if he got 2 hours away from this pickup and FFE called him and told him to turn around and come back? Would he turn around and go back? Or would he, or is he free to do as he chooses?
Legally or as a practical matter? Legally, I think he's free to do what he wants to legally, but as a practical matter, he better turn around and take it back and do what FEC says to do.
Mr. Pupe, on another matter, is causation an issue in this case?
To me, it is not. Colonel Hupp satisfies that requirement by, and Officer Meyer simply by saying that tractor rolled over due to the upper coupler assembly detaching from the trailer.
Well, how does the jury determine whether, I guess, the kingpin connecting the coupler became unconnected because it was either defective or was it caused by the crash itself? How is it? Do they just depend on their common knowledge, or do they need a little help?
Let me first clarify the mechanism of the accident.
Please, I was just doing my best with the material.
This was not a matter of the kingpin coming loose from the fifth wheel. This was a matter of the entire plate, what is called the upper coupler assembly, coming loose from the trailer. After the rollover, the kingpin, this upper plate, all of that was still stuck in the fifth wheel. It stayed attached to the tractor. All of the bolts around the base rail and or some vertical bolts going up through this plate, which there's a dispute about whether those exist, all of those came out or broke, missing, whatever, to allow this thing to detach. Now, the second part of the question, how does the jury know whether negligence was involved and failing to discover that? Was that the second part?
Part of the negligence is one of the elements, yes.
I don't contend that the average layman knows everything about inspecting a refrigerated trailer. I'd be the first to grant they do not. My position is that when a jury is informed, whether by layman or by experts, enough about the mechanics of how something works, explains how it rolled over, explains how it came off, explains it came off due to either missing bolts, loose bolts, or rusted bolts, when the jury is shown all of that, shown when it was inspected, shown caution that the inspection should catch these sort of things. When a jury is shown all that, the jury can make the determination itself that, well, a reasonable inspection would have caught this. This didn't just happen last night. This isn't like the Walmart store where someone spilled something on the floor. It takes a long time for bolts to rust to this degree that they will break. It takes a long time for them to get loose to the point that they will come out. And that's what I'm saying, that even though there was some aspects of the overall scheme that needed expert testimony, the final decision of whether a jury can determine whether a reasonable inspection would catch these loose bolts or these rusted bolts, to me, the average layman can make that decision. This is just like the Abrams v. McTiger, where there was some expert testimony in certain aspects, what needs to be done and all this. But when you get down to the gut question, the bottom question, should a reasonable inspection have caught this, that I say the average layman can has enough knowledge to judge that.
The part I don't understand about this is if you have all of that expert testimony you say you need about how it is put together and when you should inspect it and what will happen if you, why couldn't or didn't the expert say and the failure to catch that was negligence?
That's an ultimate issue that I don't think is necessary in our law. The ultimate issue was this negligence. I don't think it's necessary for any expert to say that. In any case, I understand the standard of care and breach of the standard of care, but I don't think that the expert has to say this was negligence.
But
could the fellow, I've forgotten his name, starts with a B, I think.
Mallory?
No, it wasn't Mallory.
You
said it needed to be inspected every 60 days.
Yeah, the director of maintenance.
Right.
That was the dependents expert?
It was their employee, ex-employee. He was the director of maintenance for several years.
He said it was inspected every 60 days, or it was required, it needed to be inspected every 60 days?
He said both. Also, he said that these trailers went through lane inspection. In other words, any time they come through the Lancaster yard and is there to fill up or whatever, they go through inspections each time they come through there as what's called, quote, a lane inspection.
The safety inspector who testified, I think, who was hired by the FFE, who testified that this needed to be inspected every 60 days.
They did. That was Bill Robinson, their safety director. That was not a retained expert.
All right. But he could have testified that, I guess in addition, or could he, that the failure to find loose, rusty, missing bolts was negligence, or you should have found them if you were looking.
If I could have gotten a defense witness to say that for me, yes, that would have been beautiful. He did say that a reasonable inspection should catch rusted bolts, a reasonable inspection should catch this shiny area. I think he said, no, he said loose and missing bolts should catch. And I think he also said, it might have been just Mallory, he said, should catch the shiny area around the head of a loose bolt. But I mean, I did not ask him whether it was negligence. I mean, I didn't think that. I didn't think Wilson would ever do that for me.
Right.
What about the lost evidence? Let's talk about that for a little bit. Now, there was some important piece of this trailer that was in the possession of defendants, and it disappeared at some point. And now, normally you would be looking for some type of jury instruction, and obviously this was directed verdict before it got to the jury. So what evidence, before you rested, if any, was directed towards that this was lost and that you were building a basis for, you know, a future request for an instruction?
There was
were you going to wait until and do it in a separate hearing, or should you do that before the trial, or did you handle it during your case?
Well, it was definitely handled during the discussion of the directed verdict. The judge says, I realize that you're probably entitled to a spoliation instruction.
But facts underlying that judicial decision, where are those in the record?
I think I even quoted them in the brief. They came from Bill Robinson, FFE's maintenance director. He says, I realized there was going to be litigation regarding this. I realized that there was a problem with the upper coupler.
So you think there's a factual record that would support a jury instruction on spoliation against the defendants?
Definitely.
And that should have been considered in a directed verdict, application of directed verdict standard by the judge?
Yes. Okay. This was a pretty egregious case of spoliation. I mean, when you've got the defendant's upper-level management realizing that there's probably going to be litigation regarding this upper coupler assembly, they bring it back to their plant because they figure there's going to be litigation. They give the instruction, you save this upper coupler assembly because there's going to be litigation. They instruct the risk department, there's going to be litigation, save this piece, and then sometime it disappears. We don't know when. As far as Bill Robinson knew, it was still there 7 months after suit was filed.
It would be your position, if we overturn the Court of Appeals opinion, we ought to send it back to the Court of Appeals for a review on that question.
Consider the spoliation evidence, because I think it does fill in any gaps that are missing in the evidentiary record. Again, this upper coupler assembly is this whole bottom plate. And while this spoliation issue is so important, all the witnesses at the scene said that this upper coupler assembly detached from the trailer because of bolts going up through the floor of the trailer, up through this plate going vertically, that all those were rusted and broken in two. Manufacturer says those bolts don't exist. That's not our design. I had photographs, but there was no way that I could tell from those photographs whether these rusted bolts relied upon Colonel Huff and the other witnesses, whether those were actually bolts that attached it attach this plate to the trailer or not. I just, and of course, I couldn't evaluate the rust issue from any retained expert. I asked Colonel Huff, you know, what I could about those bolts, but I couldn't explore hardly the rust issue at all because I never had the upper coupler assembly to where I could look at the rust issue.
You've asserted in your brief that the trial judge should have considered the spoliation determination, as you've called it, where the judge said, I believe there was spoliation, but he didn't consider it in his directed verdict. How do you think a finding of spoliation should play into a directed verdict?
You say, well, according to Justice Baker in his concurrence in the Trevino case, he says that if the spoliation is of the type that it raises the rebuttable presumption of negligence, then it is enough by itself to survive a directed verdict. If it's the other type of spoliation issue, to where a jury is simply instructed that it would be unfavorable, the spoliated evidence would be unfavorable, then the trial court should at least consider it. It may not be by itself enough to survive a directed verdict, but the trial court should at least consider that in weighing the evidence whether there's enough to survive a directed verdict.
Okay. And if the trial judge thinks that there was spoliation, should that automatically mean that the case survives a directed verdict, in your opinion? Or do you think
under the facts of this case, I don't want hypothetical all situations, but under the facts of this case, if he felt it was the spoliation that created the rebuttable presumption, then yes, that enough under the fact of this case, no directed verdict should be granted.
I have one more question on the liability piece. Let's suppose I'm a passenger on a plane or a bus or a train, and something happens to that plane, train, or bus, and it turns over, crashes, and I'm injured. Can I sue the transportation company under strict liability?
You're the passenger on the plane.
Or a bus or a train. Something to that.
Something that. Where the common carrier rule might apply.
Or just in a product liability context, let's say something is wrong with that train, plane, or bus, and it is involved in a crash, and I'm injured. Can I sue under a theory of...
Good question. Not that all the questions were not good. That is interesting. That is interesting. Common carrier has purchased a plane from Boeing, we'll say, and there's a defect in that plane. I know it hasn't been done to my knowledge in a law, and I guess the difference is the passenger never took control of the product. American Airlines retained control over that product. I mean, not only by virtue of the fact that its pilots were flying it, but the passenger had no right to do anything other than ask the stewardess to help him. So the passenger never got control of the profit, I mean, of the product by ticket or otherwise. I think that's the distinction that would be applied there.
So what about the driver or the pilot of the train, bus, or plane? Does it matter whether they're an employee or employer, whether they get to sue for strict liability?
Well, definitely it would not be strict liability if it's an employee. But let's say an independent contractor flew this America's plane full of passengers. I think you would have to look at the agreement itself to see what the rights and responsibilities of each party were, to see whether there might have been that transfer of possession sufficient to invoke product liability law. For example, if he rented the whole plane, let's say this independent contractor rented the whole plane, like in a charter to Vegas or something like that, and there was something wrong with the plane, then yes.
Let's say I'm a charter outfit. That's exactly what I was thinking. I've run private planes or jets or whatever, but I hire my pilots as independent contractors, and I tell them, you pick up this group here, be on the runway at X time, and fly them to Las Vegas and back. And if that plane were to crash in transit, would the pilot have a cause of action against me based on strict liability?
I think, again, you would have to look at the contract. What was his rights and responsibilities under that agreement? If he had the right to use the product, if he was renting the product, as opposed to just hire, drive the vehicle, so to speak. I'm not for sure that product liability would apply unless he had legal possession of the entire aircraft. And I guess back to the FFE situation, let's assume that. That's one of those situations where it seems like he's so much like an employee, and I would bet that the legal agreement would say, you're going to leave this plane when we say, I mean, take it when we say, go the route we say, do everything attached to that. And I don't know. Just as a hypothetical, I think I'd have to go back to the agreement and see what the agreement provided. It might in some cases, it might not in other cases.
What about in FFE and your client, if at the loading dock there was a ladder that was owned by FFE that was had a defect and they loaned it to your client and blew apart and he got injured, would FFE be strictly liable?
No, they're not in the business of leasing ladders or loaning ladders.
Same thing with the Firestone tire or whatever tire was attached to this trailer if it blew out.
You got to have the criteria that the lessor was in the business of leasing products of similar kind.
So if we characterize FFE's business as transportation of commodities, there's no strict liability?
But how did they accomplish that? They accomplished that by leasing their trailers.
And by putting tires on them and by providing ladders.
Well, if the defect in the trailer was a defective tire, if we had the same situation and it wasn't the upper cupper assembly but a defective tire, then yes, my argument would be that strict liability would apply. But that's different than the ladder that's hanging on the side of the truck or something like that. I mean, to me, that's the distinction. What is the regular business?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
First of all, Your Honors, the FFE does not lease its trailers. Court of Appeals can characterize it as a lease, but it is not a lease arrangement. FFE is paid by its customers for the goods that it hauls from place to place. Mr. Fulgham then gets a percentage of that payment. But there is not a direct, okay, Mr. Fulgham, we will lease this trailer to you. You pay us X amount for that lease. So there's not a lease. There is a transfer of possession. I don't think there's any question about that. But getting to Justice Owen's concerns, the focus is whether you're in the business of doing that, is whether that is your business, and where you own a plane and you charter that plane and you hire a pilot. Your business is not selling planes or leasing planes or providing planes to people for their own personal use. Your business is a service, and your business is transporting people from place to place. And so, you know, for the airline industry or the bus industry, you're providing a service. The bus company, the airline company, they are the consumers of those products. They are the end user of those products, and they're using those products to further their business. And in that role, they are not strictly liable for product defects.
Mr. Spaulding, does the record reflect what happened to the upper coupling assembly?
The upper coupler assembly was retained by FFE, and we don't know what happened to it. It was lost.
Was there an order signed by the trial court about the spoliation, or do you agree with Mr. Fuquay that the trial judge simply said that the plaintiff was probably entitled to a spoliation instruction?
He did say that. He did say that during the hearing on the expert testimony and the direct verdict. But what he also said was that he did not think it was a severe presumption. And looking to Trevino versus Ortega, you know, in order for spoliation to have any effect on the directed verdict in this case, it had to arise in a situation and it had to preclude the plaintiff from proving their case. And plaintiff's own expert witness at the trial of this case, he didn't need the upper coupler assembly because what he had and what he decided was that the bolts that these witnesses saw at the scene of the accident, the bolts that some implied may have been protruding vertically into the underside of the trailer, that those did not exist. That what did exist are base rails that run along the side of the trailer. And it's these base rails that are then bolted into the upper coupler assembly. And according to plaintiff's own expert, that is what holds the upper coupler assembly to the trailer. And what the expert did get to look at was the expert got to look at those base rails, which are, the base rails are on the outside of the upper coupler assembly. And the expert's testimony was that, based on his examination of the base rail, and he also testified that even if he had the upper coupler assembly to look at, his analysis of it would have been the same as the analysis he conducted on the base rail, which was based on the bolt holes and shiny areas around those bolt holes, that there was evidence that there were loose bolts that were very loose or gone at the time of the accident, and that's what caused the upper coupler assembly to break free of the trailer and roll. So there's no requirement in this case that the spoliation that occurred did not prevent the directed verdict in this case. It was not necessary for the plaintiffs to prove this case, and according to Justice Baker, he still had the burden to prove his case.
Now you said the trial judge said that a presumption was not warranted for, what was the wording you used? For what reason?
He said he did not think it was a severe presumption.
Severe presumption.
According to Justice Baker, if it's an intentional spoliation, certainly you get an instruction that was going to be unfavorable to the other side, and where it's intentional, that's not required.
Okay. So because is there a record of the hearing? This hearing on the directed verdict in the
there is a record.
So we can go. What's your opinion on it? Are you saying that because the trial judge did not think a severe presumption applied here, that the spoliation that he thought probably occurred should not be considered in the directed verdict ruling, or did something else happen?
No, I think if it's the less severe presumption, then I don't think spoliation has any impact on whether the directed verdict could be granted. And I think the other thing that you have to look at is the evidence that was in front of the trial court and what was. And the focus of plaintiff's negligence allegations, and the focus was that FFB should have detected loose or rusty bolts, and the bolts that broke free or that fell out, nobody recovered those. The bolts were not spoliated. I mean, it's the rusty bolts and whether they were of such had reached such a corrosive extent that they would have failed, that they would have no longer had the strength to hold that trailer, and they would have failed. And there's no evidence of any spoliation of those.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank
that concludes the arguments of today's cases, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise.